Hi, listeners, it's Vanessa. Before we get into today's episode, I want to tell you about another show I think you'll love, Hidden History with Dr. Harini Bhatt. Every Monday, Dr. Bhatt goes where history gets mysterious, vanished civilizations, doomsday prophecies, paranormal phenomena, and events that science still can't fully explain. Dr. Bhatt treats these moments like open case files, not myths, not superstition, just incomplete explanations waiting for a closer look. Hidden History drops every Monday. Follow now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen so you never miss a mystery.
This is Crime House.
All right, friends, you know what time it is. It's time for your daily true crime rundown. Grab your coffee, settle in, let's talk about the cases everyone's going to be discussing today. We're starting with the biggest one. A teenage barrel racing competitor is under arrest after three horses were stabbed in the middle of the night at a Las Vegas equestrian center, and the animals she allegedly targeted were her fellow competitors' horses. This is Crime House 24/7, your nonstop source for the biggest crime cases developing right now. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Vanessa Richardson, and we have quite a lineup for you today. Here's what you need to know. Okay, let's take you back to Saturday, May 30th. It's just after 2 a.m. Most competitors and their families are sleeping, or at least they're trying to, ahead of what should have been a big day of competition at the 2026 National Barrel Horse Association Professionals Choice Vegas Super Show at the South Point Hotel and Casino. The event, which is one of the largest barrel racing competitions in the country, had gotten underway on Friday and was scheduled to run through Sunday. Now, to understand the weight of this story, it helps to understand what barrel racing is and what it means to the people who compete in it. It's a rodeo sport in which horse and rider work together to complete a cloverleaf pattern around three barrels in the fastest possible time. It sounds simple, right? But the level of athleticism required from the horses is extraordinary. These animals are conditioned athletes. Their riders spend years building a partnership with them, and the horses themselves are often the most valuable thing a competitor owns, not to mention the almost familial bond they develop. At an event like the NBHA Vegas Super Show, which draws professional-level competitors from across the country, the horses in those barns represent not just financial investment, but entire careers, relationships, and livelihoods. So, sometime in the quiet hours before dawn on Saturday, someone entered the barn where horses were being housed for the event. What happened next was, by all accounts, deliberate. According to the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, three horses were intentionally injured with what investigators believe was a knife. Officers with LVMPD received the initial call at approximately 2:07 a.m. about an injured horse at a barn near the 9700 block of South Las Vegas Boulevard, which is where the South Point Arena and Equestrian Center is located. When patrol officers arrived, the situation turned out to be worse than that initial report. Not one, but three horses had been hurt. Police described the injuries as intentional, noting that each horse had been attacked with a sharp object. The good news, as limited as it was, is that the injuries were not considered life-threatening, but they were significant enough that all three horses would be unable to compete in the Vegas Super Show. These were animals that had been trained, prepared, and brought to Las Vegas specifically to compete. In a single act, in the middle of the night, their entire reason for being there was taken away. The LVMPD's Animal Cruelty Section, I also love knowing that that exists, took over the investigation from there. Detectives started piecing together who had been in or near the barn around the time the horses were injured. What they found was that a 17-year-old girl had access to that barn, and she quickly became a person of interest. Detectives were able to locate the teen at a nearby hotel. She was taken into custody and transported to Clark County Juvenile Hall, where she was booked on serious charges, 12 counts of willful or malicious killing, maiming, or torturing an animal, and 3 counts of felony malicious destruction of private property valued at more than $5,000. That charge breakdown is worth pausing on. 12 counts for three horses tells us that investigators determined each horse sustained multiple distinct injuries, meaning this was not a single act of violence. It appears each animal was injured more than once. The three counts of felony malicious destruction of private property over $5,000 reflect the monetary value of competition horses. These are not backyard animals. At events like the Vegas Super Show, horses can be worth tens of thousands of dollars or significantly more. Police have not publicly released the teen's name, but what we do know from reporting by the Las Vegas Review-Journal and People magazine is that at least one other young competitor at the event had spoken with the suspect in the days before the attack. Callie Raymer, a 17-year-old competitor, told the Las Vegas Review-Journal that she'd talked to the suspect a few times prior to the incident. Raymer said, quote, "It's kind of scary that something like that would happen here," end quote. That quote captures something important. This didn't happen in some dark, anonymous corner of the world. It happened in a tight-knit sporting community, at an event surrounded by families, young athletes, and people who have devoted a significant portion of their lives to this sport. The competitors who woke up Saturday morning to find their horses injured and unable to race did not just lose a competition. In some cases, they may have lost an animal they love and have worked alongside for years. The National Barrel Horse Association issued a statement describing what occurred as, quote, "the mistreatment of a limited number of equine athletes by an event competitor," end quote. The NBHA said the situation was addressed immediately and coordinated with the South Point Hotel and Casino Security, the LVMPD, and all appropriate parties. They confirmed the individual involved had been removed from the event and placed in the care of authorities and stated there was no ongoing threat to anyone at the show. They also asked for respect and understanding for all involved during what they called a sensitive time. The South Point Hotel Casino and Spa also issued a statement emphasizing that the safety and well-being of all guests, participants, and equine athletes on the property is their highest priority. They thanked law enforcement and the NBHA for their immediate response and said the resort is fully cooperating with the investigation. As of now, a motive has not been publicly disclosed by law enforcement. We don't yet know the relationship between this teen and the owners of the three horses that were injured, whether there was a specific dispute between competitors, some kind of rivalry, or something else driving what happened in that barn. Those are questions investigators are almost certainly working to answer right now. In competitive circuits like this one, where the same families and athletes travel the same event calendars year after year, the community is small enough that relationships, grievances, and histories can run deep. But that is speculation at this stage. What is confirmed is the arrest, the charges, and those three horses that didn't get to do what they were brought to Las Vegas to do. The Vegas Super Show concluded on Sunday, May 31st. The NBHA's statement made clear the association's priority is the well-being of all horses in attendance, and they emphasized that steps had been taken to ensure that. As for the teen, now in Clark County Juvenile Hall, her case will move through the juvenile justice system, where the proceedings and any outcomes are typically handled with more confidentiality than adult cases. The charges she faces, however, are not minor. Felony animal cruelty in Nevada carries real consequences, even for juveniles. From a competition-turned-crime scene in Las Vegas, we now turn to a disappearance that has gripped the country for more than 4 months now, and that got significant new attention this weekend, also in Las Vegas, at a very different kind of gathering. If you've been following the case of Nancy Guthrie, the 84-year-old mother of Today Show anchor Savannah Guthrie, you know that investigators have been searching since February with very few public answers. But this weekend, a panel of experts took the stage at CrimeCon and shared details raising serious new questions about how this investigation has been handled.
Do you want to sneak past the crime scene tape to explore the key evidence behind some of the most gripping true crime cases? I'm Morgan Apsher.
And I'm Kaylin Moore.
And we'd love for you to check out our new show, Clues.
Each Wednesday, I piece together the timelines and break down the hard facts, digging into forensic details, investigative techniques, and everything that led to justice, or didn't.
And while Kaylin dives into the facts, I'm pulling at the threads, digging through the internet theories, and looking at the details that may or may not add up.
From serial killers to shocking cold cases, we shine a light on the stories that have been waiting, sometimes for decades, to finally be heard.
So join us as we uncover the breakthroughs, the heartbreak, and the relentless pursuit of answers behind the world's most unforgettable investigations.
Come open a case file with us every Wednesday and listen to Clues wherever you get your podcasts.
Nancy Guthrie was 84 years old when she was last seen on February 1st, 2026, at her home in Tucson, Arizona. It's hard to believe more than 4 months have passed since then. Despite hundreds of tips, extensive search efforts, and a family that has poured enormous personal resources into finding her, she has not been located. No suspect has been publicly identified. No motive has been determined. That is the backdrop against which a CrimeCon panel took place this past Friday, May 29th, in Las Vegas, and the details that emerged were significant enough to draw fresh national attention to the case. The panel included Fox News digital reporter Michael Ruiz, defense attorney Donna Rotunno, Fox Nation analyst and former investigator Paul Morrow, and investigator Josh Ritter. Together, they broke down the case in front of a live audience, and several of them shared new information they had received directly, in some cases just before walking out onto that stage. Michael Ruiz opened with a disclosure that immediately set the tone for the discussion. He told the audience that he'd heard from what he described as a very good federal source moments before the panel began that investigators are now discussing bringing in new technological tools to assist with the search for Nancy. He didn't specify what those tools are, and no further details have been publicly disclosed, but the announcement signals that the investigation may be shifting in meaningful ways after months of what many observers have characterized as stagnation. Then came one of the most striking revelations of the afternoon. Defense attorney Donna Rotunno disclosed that Savannah Guthrie has now spent approximately $500,000 of her own money hiring private investigators and outside specialists to work the case independently of law enforcement. Rotunno framed that figure plainly as a sign of how unsatisfied Savannah is with where the official investigation stands. Rotunno said, quote, "So that tells me she's not satisfied, and I don't think she has a lot of faith in where law enforcement has taken us to this point," end quote. Reports citing sources close to the family describe Savannah as deeply determined, unwilling to scale back the search regardless of how much time passes. The private team she's funded reportedly includes former federal agents, security experts, and specialized investigators who are actively reviewing and pursuing leads on a daily basis. The Guthrie family's reward for information leading to Nancy's whereabouts or a resolution of the case is $1 million. The FBI has separately offered a $100,000 reward. Together, that's more than $1.1 million on the table. And still, after more than 4 months, no answers. The panel also addressed serious criticism of how the investigation was handled from the very beginning. Rotunno was pointed in her critique, suggesting investigators initially approached what happened to Nancy with entirely the wrong mindset. She said, quote, "Initially, everyone thought this was a missing person case, and the way they walked into it initially probably wasn't with the right set of lenses," end quote. That distinction is not a small one. A missing person case and a suspected kidnapping require fundamentally different investigative approaches from the first hours, different evidence gathering, different witness interviews, different urgency in how law enforcement engages with federal partners and outside agencies. Rotunno also raised concerns about the crime scene itself, specifically the failure to gather certain pieces of evidence and to properly restrict access to Nancy's home. Michael Ruiz said he was actually able to walk directly up to the front door of Nancy Guthrie's residence while reporting on the case. A deputy on the scene at the time told him it was fine to approach. That detail landed hard in the room. Paul Morrow pointed out that failures to properly secure and preserve a crime scene early on can have serious downstream consequences. Evidence collected later can be challenged in court, and a defense attorney worth their fee will exploit every gap in the chain of custody. One of the most troubling specific threads to emerge from the panel involves a single strand of hair recovered from Nancy Guthrie's home. The Pima County Sheriff's Office, the lead agency on the case, sent the hair to a laboratory in Florida rather than routing it directly to the FBI's lab in Quantico, Virginia. According to Court TV's reporting on the panel, despite the FBI reportedly sending a plane to collect the sample from the scene, federal agents waited approximately 11 weeks before they were finally able to access it. 11 weeks. In a case where every day without answers is another day a family doesn't know where their mother is. Then there are the ransom notes. Since Nancy's disappearance, ransom-style notes have surfaced in connection with the case. All four panelists at CrimeCon were in agreement on this point. Those notes almost certainly did not come from an actual kidnapper. The notes reportedly lacked two of the most fundamental elements investigators expect from genuine ransom communications. First, any sense of urgency, and second, proof of life. In a real kidnapping, a ransom note is a negotiating tool. It's designed to create pressure and to demonstrate that the kidnapper actually has the victim. Without urgency and without proof of life, the note has no leverage, which means it serves no functional purpose for someone actually trying to collect a ransom. The detail that arguably crystallized it best was where one of those notes reportedly surfaced. Investigator Josh Ritter pointed to the fact that TMZ received information connected to the case. Ritter said, quote, "The last place you go to is TMZ. To me, that was someone looking for attention rather than looking to gain a ransom in a legitimate kidnapping," end quote. If the panelists are right that these notes were not written by whoever took Nancy, then the question becomes who wrote them and why? What would motivate someone to inject themselves into the disappearance of an elderly woman with a famous daughter? I can guess, but that's not my job right now. I'm just reporting the facts. As of this recording, Nancy Guthrie has been missing for more than 4 months. The Pima County Sheriff's Office remains the lead investigating agency. Anyone with information is asked to contact the Pima County Sheriff's Office or the FBI directly. With over $1 million in reward money available, new technological tools reportedly under consideration, and a privately funded investigation now running parallel to the official one, this case has significant resources behind it. For Nancy Guthrie's family, and especially for Savannah Guthrie, more than 120 days without answers is an almost unimaginable stretch of time to be waiting and not knowing. As always, we'll keep following this as it develops. Okay, before I let you go, you know we can't end without giving you a little something extra. Over on America's Most Infamous Crimes Today, Katie's covering part one of the Clutter family, who murdered them in their own home. On the night of November 14, 1959, four members of the Clutter family were bound and shot dead in their farmhouse in Holcomb, Kansas. Nothing of value had been stolen. The doors, as always, had been unlocked. In the first of three episodes on the Clutter family murders, Katie Ring traces who the Clutters really were, and the morning when friends and neighbors arrived for church and found them gone. This was the case that changed how America thinks about small-town safety and inspired one of the most famous books ever written. This episode contains descriptions of murder and violence. Please listen with care. We grabbed a clip from today's episode. Take a listen. And if you like what you hear, don't forget to follow America's Most Infamous Crimes.
Before we talk about what happened to the Clutter family, I think it's important to really understand who they were. Because this isn't just a story about a crime. It's a story about a family that represented something to the people around them. And when that family was taken away, the loss went far beyond four lives. So let's start with the man at the center of it all, Herbert William Clutter. Herb Clutter was 48 years old in November of 1959. He was a farmer, a father, and one of the most respected men in all of Western Kansas. He ran a place called River Valley Farm just outside of Holcomb, a small town with a population of about 270 people. And River Valley Farm was something truly special. Picture vast fields of wheat stretching out in every direction, horses and cattle grazing on green pastures, and a grove of fruit trees that Herb kept in perfect condition. In the center of it all was a big, sturdy farmhouse home. And this property wasn't a family heirloom. Herb built everything he had through sheer hard work and discipline. On top of all of his hard work, the man never touched a drop of alcohol in his life, and he expected the same from anyone who worked for him. If you were employed on Herb Clutter's farm, you didn't drink, period. That might sound strict, but people respected it because Herb led by example. He wasn't the type to ask anything of someone that he wasn't willing to do himself. Beyond the farm, Herb was deeply involved in his community. He'd been active in local politics and had recently led the effort to build a new Methodist church in town. He also served on the Federal Farm Credit Board and was the kind of guy that people turned to when they needed advice, help, or just someone to listen. In a town as small as Holcomb, where everybody knew everybody, Herb Clutter was the person everyone trusted the most. And here's the thing about Herb. He was principled, sure, but he wasn't cold or distant. By all accounts, he was generous with his time and his resources. He was known for giving his employees advances on their pay if they were having a tough week and helping neighbors out with their own farming problems without being asked. In a community that probably wouldn't throw around a word like beloved, it was clear that's exactly what he was. Now, Herb's wife, Bonnie, had her own story. She was the only daughter of a successful wheat farmer, so she understood farm life from the very beginning. But as a young woman, Bonnie had big dreams. She wanted to go into nursing because she had grown up admiring Florence Nightingale and wanted to follow in her footsteps, so she enrolled in nursing school. But after 2 years of dealing with the difficult realities of hospital work, Bonnie decided it wasn't for her and dropped out. Shortly after that, she married Herb. They'd been connected through Bonnie's older brother, who was Herb's classmate. And even though Herb didn't come from the same kind of money that Bonnie did, she saw something in him. He had plans, ambition, and wanted to build a farm and a family that he could be proud of. It was everything Bonnie was looking for, and by all accounts, their marriage was a good one. But it also came with real challenges. After the birth of their first daughter, Ivana, in 1936, something shifted in Bonnie. A kind of sadness settled over her that she just couldn't shake. These days, doctors would most likely diagnose her with postpartum depression, but a diagnosis like this didn't even exist back then. The term postpartum depression wouldn't even be officially coined by the psychiatric community for nearly 60 years, so Bonnie didn't get the kind of help she needed. She went to clinics and visited treatment centers, but nothing seemed to make a lasting difference. And with each new baby, it got a little worse. After their youngest, Kenyon, was born in 1944, the sadness lingered. It became part of Bonnie's life. There were good days and bad days, but the fog never fully lifted. It's important to mention this because I think it explains a lot about how the Clutter household actually worked day to day, and the role that their teenage daughter, Nancy, ended up playing in the family. Honestly, when you learn about this girl, it's hard not to be amazed by her. Nancy Clutter was 16 years old, and she was one of those people who just lit up every room she walked into. She was a straight-A student, president of her class, was active in 4-H and in her church, was an actress, a musician, and she'd won awards for her baking, including a cherry pie that was apparently legendary around town. But what really set Nancy apart wasn't just the list of accomplishments. It was the way she treated people. She was constantly making time for others, whether it was younger kids in the community who looked up to her or her own family members who needed her help. On the morning of November 14th, 1959, the day before the murders, Nancy spent part of her morning teaching a 13-year-old girl named Jolene Katz how to bake one of her famous cherry pies. On top of all of this, with Bonnie often struggling with her depression, a huge amount of the responsibility for running the household fell squarely on Nancy's shoulders. She handled errands for her mom, helped manage the house, and still found time for her own life and her own ambitions. Because Nancy had big plans. She wanted to go to Kansas State University and study art with her best friend, Susan Kidwell. She had her whole future mapped out. But for now, in November of 1959, she was exactly where she needed to be. at home, being helpful, being generous, being the person everyone in Holcomb knew her to be. Nancy's little brother, Kenyon, was a totally different kind of kid. Where Nancy was social, outgoing, and involved in everything, Kenyon was quiet and a bit of a loner. In November of 1959, he was 15 years old and already taller than anyone else in his family. He liked to hunt, enjoyed woodworking, and he spent a lot of his free time tinkering with an old truck that his father had let him buy when he was just 11. Kenyon wasn't the type to seek attention. He was more comfortable working with his hands than working a crowd. But he had a gentle way about him. On the last afternoon, he was out working on a flower bed that Bonnie liked to keep outside of her bedroom window, just doing something nice for her. While Kenyon was working, Nancy came riding up on her horse, Babe. The family dog, Teddy, and Nancy's cat, Evan Rude, joined the kids. A family friend named Paul Helm, who was married to the Clutters' housekeeper, was also there that afternoon. He'd later recall listening to Kenyon and Nancy talk about their older sister's upcoming visit, about Thanksgiving plans, and about Kenyon's horse, Skeeter, who died a year earlier. Kenyon was still grieving that horse in his own quiet way. As the light started to fade, Paul Helm said his goodbyes and headed back to his home about a half mile away. As he walked off, he looked back over his shoulder at the kids. But little did he know, it would be the last time he would ever see them alive.
That's Katie Ring, host of America's Most Infamous Crimes, and that's just a taste. Part one on the Clutter Family is out right now on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Just search America's Most Infamous Crimes and make sure you follow so you don't miss parts two and three. You've been listening to Crime House 24/7, bringing you breaking crime news. I'm Vanessa Richardson. We'll be back tomorrow morning with more developing stories. Stay safe, and thanks for listening.